Avalon County Entertainment System. Channel Select. Avalon Broadcasting System. Channel 17. Program Start. Wednesday. Oshima. Greater Rigel Sector Co-Prosperity Sphere. United Federation of Planets. You know, said the chief thoughtfully, I have to give Big Fire credit for chutzpah, if nothing else. I mean, it takes a certain something to believe you can succeed where malevolent cosmic beings failed. Professor Kenjiro Ishiki nodded sagely. A certain something, and a certain lack of something else. Griffin agreed. There is that. Still, you have to give them points for trying hard.
True, said Professor Ishiki. And they keep life interesting for an old man.
With that, the two fell silent, sitting back in their deck chairs on the roof of the tall seaside building and sipping umbrella drinks while they watched the best show on Oshima. A few miles to the northeast, out across the bay, Big Fire's latest giant robot-based attempt to seize the Incarnate Engine, and thereby hold the planet's entire energy supply for ransom, was fully underway. For two such experienced observers as Ishiki and the Chief, it was apparent that the organization had pulled out all the stops for this attempt. The robot they were using this time was gigantic even by the generally outlandish standards of Big Fire's terror mecha, no mere building smasher or Category 2K unit, but a full-on Daikaiju-class destruction machine, the kind of thing that could bring whole cities to their knees. Further, that robot's operator was one of their best, or worst, depending on one's point of view, Ivan the Terrible Ivanko, an Esper agent only one rank removed from the Magnificent Ten and nearly on par with them in combat ability. The personal aide to Shockwave Alberto himself, Ivan the Terrible, was infamous throughout the galactic counterterrorism community for his viciousness, his skill at operating terror mecha, and his truly amazing nose. You realize when they beat him, that'll just convince Alberto to come here himself, Griffin observed conversationally as one of the nine tiny, brightly colored figures doing battle with Ivan's robot destroyed one of its weapon emplacements with a high-speed aerial crossing attack. Ishiki put down his empty plastic coconut and crossed his arms decisively. At about time, too, he said with a firm nod. We want to have this business wrapped up before Akane and the girls have to leave for college. You think they're really ready to take on a member of the Magnificent Ten? Griffin wondered, sounding not skeptical, but curious. I do, Ishiki said with another decisive nod. The original five have been at this for 6 years now, and Momo and her friends for four. I've kept developing the Vivid system this whole time, and, well, look at them, he added, gesturing to the ongoing battle, as one of Ivan's robot's arms parted midway between shoulder and elbow in a spray of green light. They don't even need me on the radio coaching them anymore. I'd stake their talent against any opposition in the galaxy. And my own, of course, as the system's brilliant creator, he added immodestly. Said Griffin. Looks like they're coming to the main event, he continued a moment later, as the colored points of light that were all he could see of the tiny combatants assumed a familiar aerial formation. Ishiki leaned forward, a broad, anticipatory grin spreading onto his goateed face. So they are. Make your prediction, if you please, Chief. I think blue, said Griffin after a moment's thought, placing a 20-credit bill on the small table between the two deck chairs.
Bah, amateur! It'll be green for certain, said Ishiki, banging his own wager down on top of the first.
A moment later, Before Griffin had an opportunity to reply, the light coming from the battlefield brightened markedly and became mostly green.
"Ha ha!" Ishiki crowed, snatching the money from the table. "You see? When it comes to those girls, Ishiki Kenjiro is never wrong."
Griffin nodded, satisfied to have lost the bet, and finished his own tropical zombie as the remains of Ivan's robot crumbled into the bay. "I hope Ivan can swim," he remarked. Flying Yak Studios and Bacon Comics Group, in association with the International Police Organization and Avalon Broadcasting System, present Lensman, the Brave and the Bold, New Tricks. Tuesday, Ishiyama, Outer Rim Territories. It was a dark and stormy night. Suddenly, a shot rang out. At least that's what it sounded like to Griffin, who looked up in surprise from the book he was reading at the sound. Frowning, he cocked his head and listened hard, but now he could hear nothing but the wind, the rain battering against the windows of the cabin, and the occasional rumble or boom of thunder. For a moment, he considered the possibility that the other sound he had heard had been thunder, but it had been the wrong kind of report for that. Sendai thunder wasn't the crackly, snappy kind. It rolled and reverberated, like bass drums in the sky. He turned his head to regard Wolfgang, Beagle of the Lens, who had awakened from a sound sleep on the couch next to him and was now looking around with a similar expression of puzzlement. "Did you hear that?" Griffin asked rhetorically.
"Herf,"
Wolfgang replied. Before Griffin could pose another rhetorical question, a new anomalous sound reached his ears, surfacing from under the noise of the storm into his conscious awareness. This was so out of context that it took him a moment to recognize it, by which time he had instinctively risen to his feet, as though that would somehow increase his aural acuity. "Aircraft," he mused. "Prop-driven. Sounds like a twin." His eyebrows rose. "Piston-engined. Who in the world would be flying around up here in this weather in a piston-engined aircraft?" he wondered aloud. Then, shaking his head, he muttered to the unseen pilot, "Good luck, pal, wherever you're headed." Griffin had sat most of the way down when the sounds of the engines and props changed. The engines stuttered, cutting in and out, and the drone of the props desynchronized, taking on an unpleasant harmonic flutter as their RPMs drifted apart. Whoever was flying the plane tried to throttle up, producing a short burst of power, but then one of the engines sputtered and died altogether, followed shortly by the other. "Uh-oh," said Griffin, reversing course and returning to his feet. He was halfway to the door when the sounds of snapping branches reached him, followed by a nasty metallic crunch that sounded like it hadn't been very far away at all. No explosion, though. After the crunch, all was still but for the wind and the pounding rain. "Stay here, buddy," he said as Wolfgang jumped down from the couch. "It's not fit for man or beast out there tonight, so beast might as well stay dry while man goes out in it anyway," he added with faint, slightly forced wryness as he hauled on his oilskin drover coat and hat. "Watch the house. I'll be back soon." With a slightly disgruntled sound, Wolfgang returned to the sofa. After taking a moment to brace himself, Griffin hauled open the cabin door and plunged out into the storm. It was even worse outside than he'd thought. The rain lashed at him, nearly tearing his hat from his head before he crammed it down tighter with his free hand. His glasses were obscured instantly, like a windshield without the wipers on. Cursing, he took them off and thrust them into a pocket, then pressed on. The night was as dark as the inside of a crankcase, except when lightning illuminated the cloud deck, not far above. He could see no evidence of fire, and so had to navigate solely by what direction he thought he had heard the sound of the crash coming from. As he left the clearing where the cabin stood and entered the woods, water shed by the swaying pines struck him from different angles to the driving rain, creeping up his sleeves and down his collar. He'd be utterly drenched in minutes out in this. At least he wouldn't get lost. His Omnitool's home base mode would guide him back to the cabin even if he lost his bearings. That was a comfort. Without it, he could easily find himself blundering around out here until morning. And in this kind of weather, at this time of year, that wouldn't usefully arrive for another 8 or 9 hours.
"Hello?" he shouted. "Can anyone hear me?"
The wind snatched the words away as they passed his lips, carrying them off into the night, and he could barely hear them himself. He had no great hope that anyone else would receive them. Wondering if he'd even be able to find the wreck, let alone any potential survivors in these conditions, he set his Omnitool to scan for life signs. Anyone who had been killed in the crash, after all, wasn't going to mind waiting out here until morning. After a moment's scanning, it reported only one animal life form, besides himself and Wolfgang, within range. A flash of lightning revealed something white, a dozen yards or so ahead of him, in roughly the direction the tool was indicating its reading. Nothing in these woods was white, not in late summer. Wondering whether it was wreckage or the survivor his Omnitool was telling him about, Griffin plodded toward it. His shoes squelched on the sodden forest floor, inaudible over the storm, but palpable as a weird, disagreeable, moist vibration. Another flash, and he'd about halved the distance to the unknown object, but he still couldn't see it when full darkness returned. Even his Omnitool's hand lamp mode could penetrate this night only a few feet. He slowed down, aiming the feeble beam carefully at the ground in front of him. Whatever it was, it wouldn't do any good to step on it. The pool of orangish lamplight fell across the item a few moments later, and Griffin, bending to examine it closely, saw that it was a person, all right. He could tell precious little more than that, only that whoever it was wore a white coat or jacket of some kind, smeared with mud from the tumble its wearer had plainly taken across the wet ground, but still white enough to stand out in the arc-light flashes of lightning. Apart from that, he could tell only that the figure was human or humanoid and, strangely, did not appear to be wearing any pants. "Probably blown right off by the crash," he mused, then steeled himself for the unpleasantness of wet knees and knelt next to the sprawled form, switching his Omnitool to medical diagnostic mode. This considered the matter for a few seconds, then reported that the patient was a human female, approximately 20 standard years of age, suffering from contusions, exhaustion, a mild concussion, and incipient hypothermia, and that if not removed immediately to a warm and dry environment, she was very likely to go into shock within the next 10 minutes. No time to waste, then, he thought. And after double-checking that there were no other life signs around and that the patient had no serious internal injuries that could be worsened by moving her, he gathered her up in his arms and set off for the cabin. She was not a very large woman, but surprisingly heavy for her size, a solid, compact bundle of muscle and sinew, plainly well-conditioned by a lot of hard work. Griffin supposed abstractly that that explained how she had survived a crash that had thrown her clear of her aircraft, and her trousers, in such relatively good condition. As he was having that thought, he trod on something unexpectedly hard and stumbled, nearly dropping his unannounced collar. Regaining his footing, he crouched and played his lamp beam over it. A katana, of all things, still in its shinily lacquered wooden saya, its colors impossible to tell in the orange light of his omni-lamp. Shifting his hold slightly on the woman, he snagged the carrying strap attached to the saya with the first 2 fingers of his right hand, and then straightened up, bringing the weapon along with him. Getting the cabin door open was an interesting challenge with such a burden, but he managed to do so and get inside without dropping anything or banging his unexpected visitor's head on the door jamb. Once inside, he shouldered the door shut behind him, then stood for a moment with his back against it, catching his breath.
"Well," he said conversationally to the woman in his arms. "Tell you what, I can't wait to find out what..."
And then he looked down and discovered, to his considerable surprise, that he knew her. Tuesday, August 17th, 1943. Earth, dimension GCC number 332/S. But Griffin doesn't know any of that yet.
"What the hell, what the hell, what the hell?"
Griffin chanted, using it like a mantra as he evaded what appeared to be some sort of plasma beam fire with all the dismay-infused aerial agility at his disposal. Luckily, that was considerable, even if he had lost his helmet on the way through whatever the hell that was, and so had to rely only on shifts of his body weight and the X-15A2's limited thrust vectoring capabilities to steer. A less experienced rocketeer might have been ashed instantly. So far, he had survived 47 seconds, though he hadn't been able to take any one of those to check his watch. "Oh, come on," he cried, addressing the spaceliner-sized black and red aircraft that was, for no readily evident reason, trying to disintegrate him. "What did I do to you? If it's just that this is your piece of sky, fine, you win, I'm leaving. I could do that faster if you stop shooting at me." There was no response, but then he hadn't really expected one. This thing, no windows, no obvious hatches or portals, no visible engines, had "Robot Death Ship" written all over it. He didn't recognize the design language or the energy signature, but some things were just universal.
All right, fine," he said after another scarlet plasma beam nearly vaporized him.
Wheeling, he hauled his .45 from its holster and let fly a couple of rounds, which, as he expected, had absolutely no effect whatsoever.
"I'm shooting back. Does that make you happy?"
A moment later, the beams stopped coming. They didn't stop emerging, but the gigantic aircraft seemed not to be aiming at him anymore. Instead, it was spraying them into the air above it and off to the sides. Griffin halted, hovering in puzzlement, to consider this curious development. Now that he was no longer being bracketed by sizzling streams of raving red death, it occurred to him that he could hear... piston engines? A swarm of small aircraft swept past him then, coming from the direction he'd just been trying to flee in, bearing down on the black and red whatever it was, in what his practiced aeronaut's eye immediately recognized as an attack formation. The muzzle flashes of weapons twinkled as they opened fire, some with chattering machine guns, others with the slower, deeper thump-thump-thump of old-fashioned aviation cannon, and the sweet scent of gun smoke mingled with the acrid tang of ozone that the red beams had left behind, creating the unmistakable bouquet of aerial battle. "What?" Griffin repeated for the nth time that day, as he got a closer look and realized that the tiny aircraft weren't aircraft at all. They were women. Except, they appeared to have propellers instead of feet. "What?" Griffin said. He resisted the urge to rub his eyes like a character in a Merry Melodies cartoon, and looked more closely still. Yes, he hadn't imagined it, unless, of course, he was full dress, no fillers, hallucinating, which at this point he could not in good conscience rule out. The attackers appeared to be women from the waist up and airplanes from the waist down, with stubby wings like the hip flares on jodhpurs and propellers where their feet belonged. "They're like fighter plane mermaids," he mused. "Hey!" a voice cried from behind him. Turning, he saw one of the flying women approaching, a scowl on her face. She looked to be in her late teens or early 20s, with longish, untidily chopped orange hair, her buxom upper body crammed into what looked for all the world like a World War II vintage U.S. Army Air Force brown serge uniform blouse. She was even carrying a Browning automatic rifle, which rather completed the picture, and, incongruously, she appeared to have white rabbit ears, which rather didn't. Now that he got a really good look, Griffin realized that she wasn't a human-airplane hybrid after all. Rather, she appeared to be wearing two tiny airplanes, one on each leg, like very tall boots. Their engines hummed, props growling, as she balanced on them a few yards away and glared at him. The look of a woman who is confounded by what she sees and does not like being confounded. "What?" said Griffin once more. "Who the hell are you?" the woman demanded, then examined him more closely and added, "And what is that?" "What's it look like?" Griffin replied, feeling oddly defensive about it. "It's a jetpack." She blinked at him. "Yeah, right," she said. "That's impossible." Griffin gave her a slow down-and-up look of his own and replied dryly, "Says the woman wearing propeller-driven pants." "Okay, you got a point there," she conceded, then looked past him and remarked, "Looks like you got lucky, flyboy. The neuro has lost interest in you." Griffin pivoted and saw that the black and red thing was moving off to the, check sun angle, northwest, heading toward whatever landmass that was he could just make out on the horizon in that direction. Several of the other flying women were still harassing it, while a few others broke off and headed back toward his position. "So what outfit are you with?" the red-headed woman asked. "Liberian AAF? Your accent's right, and that's one of our pistols, but I don't recognize your unit patch." Griffin was puzzled by that until he remembered that his bomber jacket had a Wedge Defense Force Experimental Flight Test Command patch on the shoulder. "That's got to be some kind of super experimental gear, am I right? Another one of those make the witches obsolete things? I bet it's so secret you're supposed to shoot me now that I've seen it." Griffin turned back to her and saw that, though her words had sounded like a joke, she'd backed up a little way and trained her bar on him. "Whoa there," he said, holstering his .45 and raising his hands. "Let's not perforate the very confused man." The others arrived then, forming up in a cautious little group around him and the woman with the bar. Their evident leader looked Japanese to Griffin, with long, straight black hair pulled back in a utilitarian ponytail, her dark gray left eye fixed with evident disapproval on his face. The right was hidden behind a white eye patch with a jaunty diagonal blue stripe. She was wearing what looked like the tunic from a naval dress uniform, white with gold shoulder boards, and had a katana and some kind of improbable aircraft cannon slung across her back. Like the redhead, she had an incongruous pair of animal ears poking out of her hair, although in her case they were triangular, black, and upright, reminding Griffin somewhat of a humanized Seleucian's primaries. "Surely," this interesting figure said. "What's going on?" "Check it out," said the redhead, surely, evidently, with a little gesture of her rifle's muzzle. "I caught a flying man." "Is that a jetpack?" said one of the others, a brunette in Wehrmacht gray, who had not one but two giant machine guns hanging from crossed shoulder straps, like a normal person might have slung a pair of messenger bags. Her extra ears were gray and pendulous, like certain breeds of dogs. Her jacket had long, pointed tails front and back, and in noticing that, it suddenly occurred to Griffin that none of them had any pants on. He supposed their airplane leggings would have made that tricky, but he might have at least expected them to be wearing shorts or something. But no, a passing breeze shifting a few coattails around made it plain that that was not the case. "Huh," he thought, and reminded himself sternly to be extra professional with the heavily armed, suspicious flying women, even if they were out here flying around in their underwear. "Impossible," said the woman next to the one in gray, a petite blonde in what appeared to be a black Luftwaffe mechanics jacket. Curiously, she didn't seem to have any extra ears, though she did, he noticed, have a tail. And so, now that he'd noticed that, did the others. What the... Seriously, what the... "Not even the Von Braun sisters could get something like that to work," the blonde went on. "Usch told me once that they tried for a year and a half, early in the war, but all they could ever get them to do was explode." "Yeah, I said that already, but what other explanation is there?" Shirley said. "We don't have time for this," the woman with the eye patch growled. "That Neroy will make landfall soon, and the others can't stop it without us. It's too big, and we're under strength as it is." "Well, what am I supposed to do with this guy, then?" Shirley wondered, then cracked a wry grin and added, "Throw him back?" "All right, look," Griffin put in before any of them could reply. "I don't have the faintest idea what the hell is going on, but whatever that black thing is, it just spent a couple of minutes trying to vaporize me for no reason, which is the kind of thing I tend to take personally. Now I've got..." He glanced at a readout on one of his X-15A2's wrist control units. 10.5 minutes of fuel left at 100% power, and nothing better to do." Looking the white-coated woman in the eye, he went on, "So why don't you lend me a bigger gun, and I'll give you a hand." "Ha! I like this guy already," Shirley declared to anybody who might happen to be listening. The woman in white looked back at him for a long moment, her face set in a fiercely contemplative frown. For a moment, her gaze flicked to the grips of his own swords, jutting up from their special housing in the top of his flight pack, but mostly her one visible eye just bored into his, as if seeking some deeper truth. Then, to his mild surprise, her scowl vanished. She laughed, a big, booming, head-back sound of genuine merriment that seemed too large to have come out of such a small woman, and said, "It's your funeral, stranger. Barkhorn, give him a gun." The brunette in the Wehrmacht jacket blinked at her. "Are you serious?" The blonde giggled. "Really, Truda? Did you really just ask Major Sakamoto if she's serious?" "If he's up to something," said Sakamoto with a pragmatic little smile, "we can always kill him later." "Okay, have it your way," said Barkhorn, unslinging one of her weapons. "Can you handle this?" she asked in a vaguely challenging way, hovering nearer to offer it to Griffin. He took it, losing a foot or two of altitude before his jetpack adjusted to compensate for his suddenly increased mass, and secured the strap over one of his own arms, settling the weapon against his left shoulder. "Huh," he said. "MG-42. Haven't seen one of these in a while." Calling the routine to his mind took a moment, but in a second or two it came back to him, and he was able to check that the machine gun was ready for action competently enough. "Okay, good to go." "All right, then," said Sakamoto. She dug in a pocket of her jacket for a second and handed him an item he presently recognized as a comm earbud, then declared in a ringing voice to all of them, "Let's move out!" As they shaped a pursuit course after the black aircraft, the blonde dropped back into formation with Griffin and asked in a cheerily friendly way, "So where did you come from, anyway?" "Well, first of all," he replied. That had been the first in a series of days that had distinguished themselves as even more surreal than the usual kind of thing, but fun, in a weird kind of way. And here, in his arms, having evidently just crashed in the woods 100 yards or so from the cabin where he was in retreat from the world, appeared to be one of the women he'd spent those days with. None other than Major Mio Sakamoto of the Imperial Fuso Naval Air Service. Her eye patch was missing, but that indicated nothing. With her eyes closed, there'd be no visible sign of the curious condition that led her to wear one anyway. Regardless, her presence here was so improbable on so many levels that he didn't want to catalog them all right now. So instead, he laid her down on the sofa, Wolfgang obligingly clearing the way, gave her a shot of Vorpinol from his first aid kit for the concussion, and then set about getting her out of her soaking wet garments. That didn't take a lot of work, since, as ever in his experience, she was only wearing two of them, her soiled and damaged navy dress jacket and a one-piece swimsuit, of the type worn for generations immemorial by high school girls on 100 Japanese-influenced worlds, including, he supposed, probably this one. An odd ensemble, but who was he to judge? He bundled her up in all the spare blankets and hung her clothes on the mantelpiece to dry, got a fire going, and scanned to make sure he'd averted her going into shock. Only when he had an affirmative answer to that question did he clamber out of his own coat and shoes and go upstairs to put on dry things himself. Mio Sakamoto woke up, sat up, and briefly wondered where the hell she was. It appeared to be a loft, squeezed under the pitched roof of a log cabin, a small room with walls angling sharply upward to a ridgepole point overhead, and no proper ceiling. The space was just barely bigger than the queen-size bed she found herself in, with narrow aisles on either side, and any normal-sized person would have to stoop to negotiate them. The only way to approach the bed standing fully upright would be to come straight at the footboard in the center. For just a moment, Mio entertained the slightly comical notion that this was what awaited the dead, in which case the afterlife was a surprisingly rustic experience. She wouldn't have expected, for instance, to find quite so many soft, snuggly wool blankets and colorful native Liberian patterns in the world beyond. While she was mulling that over, a previously unnoticed figure next to her shifted, pressing against her hip with a snuffling sigh. Blinking, she drew back the covers slightly and looked down to find a brown and white beagle cuddled up against her, his face the picture of canine contentment. In spite of her towering bemusement, the sight brought a little smile to her face, and she couldn't help petting the dog for a moment before essaying the great physical challenge of climbing out of bed. Mio had no idea how long she'd slept, long enough that full daylight was diffusing through the white curtains on the little windows at either end of the room, but she still felt more or less exhausted. Enough so that it took a few seconds for her to realize that she was wearing not a single stitch of clothing. Looking around the tiny room, she saw no evidence of the clothes she'd last been wearing, but there was a blue and white striped men's dress shirt hanging on one of the footposts of the bed. With an inward shrug, she picked it up and pulled it on. It fit her like a trench coat, the tails hanging to her knees, and she had to roll the sleeves up twice before they cleared her wrists. Even buttoned all the way to the top, the collar fell so low on her that it would have passed for daring décolletage on an evening dress, and she felt as if one or the other of her shoulders might slip out of it at any time. Still, it beat wandering around naked. Mio didn't really care about such things herself, under most conditions, but she was, after all, presumably a guest here, wherever here was. Roused by her clambering out of bed, the dog worked his own way free of the covers and hopped down alongside her, tail wagging. "I don't suppose you'd like to tell me what's going on," Mio said dryly to him, then turned and made her way down the narrow stairs to the floor below. This turned out to be a compact, comfortable-looking one-room cabin, half-living room, half-kitchen-slash-dining room. The stairs came down into the living room area, where, to her mild surprise, She found her uniform hanging on pegs above a fieldstone fireplace, gently steaming dry in front of a banked fire, and Repu Maru standing in its saya against the wall nearby. Not far away stood a brown leather sofa, still covered with rumpled bedclothes where someone else had presumably spent the night on it. By the door was a coat rack with a bulky brown raincoat and a sheathed daisho hanging on it. At the other end, in the kitchen part, a man stood with his back to the room, working at a range. Some amazing smells were drifting over from there, and Mio suddenly realized that she was intensely hungry. She considered picking up her sword, just in case, but decided against it. If this man, whoever he was, meant her any harm, he'd had ample opportunity. As she padded across the room toward the kitchen, she studied his back, the set of his shoulders, and the color of his hair, and began to wonder if she'd actually hit her target after all. And then he turned around, saw her approaching, and smiled a slightly bewildered but apparently genuine smile. "Ah, good morning," he said. "Sleep well?" Mio stopped halfway across the room and gazed at him in astonishment.
It's you,"
she said, her voice nearly a whisper.
Does this mean... did I actually make it? Do you know who I am?"
"I think I do," Griffin replied, then added with a wry smile, "You're pretty distinctive, though it is an awfully big surprise to see you here." He considered her for a moment, rubbing his chin thoughtfully, then brightened and went on, "I know. See what you make of this." Clearing his throat, he composed himself, then began, "Well, first of all, Sam Waterston sends the spy guy and the Piper Cub over to Russia, to the restaurant with the bad service, and he meets the girl who dates a pig." Mio stared for a second, then said slowly,
"And he lives in her closet for 10 years while they develop the United States rocket program."
Nodding as if in agreement, Griffin went on, "And like a fine wine, the relationship between the spy girl and the fat, stinky, balding Russian pig guy only gets better."
"And that's disgusting," said Mio, her voice working on autopilot as disused memories lit back up.
"Enter Leonard Nimoy Bill Bixby type," Griffin said. "He hands him a megaton of TNT, leads him into the woods.
And suddenly they're having a teary departure like we're supposed to care. Oh."
Mio's recitation was cut off abruptly as, with a smile, the man she was now convinced she knew came around the table and gathered her up in a warm, friendly hug.
"That'll do," he said quietly. "I have no idea how or why you did it, but welcome to my world, Major Sakamoto."
Then, turning her loose, he gestured to the nearest kitchen chair and went briskly on, "Have a seat. How do you like your eggs?" The question was rhetorical, of course. Griffin well remembered from his time in 1943 that the Major liked her eggs, and all other foodstuffs, any way she could get them. He wasn't really surprised at the huge quantity of food she put away on this occasion. Scrambled eggs with plenty of cheese, bacon, baked beans, French toast, a quart of milk. Nor was he inclined to object. After whatever she'd been through the night before, he figured she was entitled to whatever she felt like stuffing in, and he kept it coming for as long as she wanted it. Only when she'd finally slowed down and was working on her last helping of beans, did he shut down the oven, dish himself up some bacon and toast, and take a seat opposite her at the table. And only then, regarding her thoughtfully, did he realize something. "Huh," he said. Bumped out of her culinary reverie by the sound, Mio looked up from her plate. "I've never seen your right eye when it wasn't... glowing," he explained to her questioning look, making a sort of radiating gesture in front of his own. With a startled look, she put down her knife and raised her hand automatically to her face, feeling for the eye patch that wasn't there. Then, her expression closing down, she lowered her hand to the table and bowed her head, eyes closed. "So," she said, and Griffin was surprised to see a tear slip down her cheek. "It's happened, then." She gave a deep sigh, shaking herself, then added fatalistically, "Well, I knew it would." "What's happened?" he asked, but Mio shook her head. "I need some time," she said, "to adjust, to take it all on board." Griffin nodded. "Take as much as you need," he said, then suggested gently, "Now that you've eaten, why don't you try to get some more sleep? You still look done in." She said, nodding, still a little abstracted. "I think I will." She got up and started to pick up her plate, but he assured her he'd take care of the washing up and shooed her off back to bed, saying, "Take Wolfgang with you if you want. He loves a nap." When she and the Beagle came downstairs again, it was late afternoon, and Griffin was sitting on the now-cleared couch, lacing up his shoes. He looked up at the sound of her on the stairs and said, "You look like you feel a bit better. No more dark circles, at least." Mio nodded. "A bit," she agreed. "I still feel tired, but I can't sleep anymore for the moment." "Well, if you're feeling up to a little fresh air and exercise, I was just about to go see about finding what's left of your striker and dragging it out of the woods. We don't want some random hikers stumbling across extra-dimensional sorceress technology by mistake," he added with a wry smile. Nodding toward the mantelpiece, he said, "I did the best I could to clean and mend your uniform. It should be dry by now. And I think there are some shoes that'll fit you in the cupboard. If you don't feel up to it, though, don't push yourself. I'll manage." "No," she said, taking her clothes down from the pegs, then picking up her sword. "I'll give you a hand." She went into the bathroom to get dressed. When she came out, he'd rummaged in the cupboard by the door and come out with a pair of what looked like army boots that proved to be close enough to the right size for government work. "Why do you have ladies' boots in your woods cabin?" Mio wondered as they left the clearing with Wolfgang trotting happily alongside. "It's not mine," Griffin said. "It belongs to a friend of mine who happens to be a lady that's about your size. She's letting me stay here while I work through some things. Life stuff. You know how it goes." Mio looked faintly shocked. "You're in retreat?" She looked down, her right fist closing, and shook her head, disgusted with herself. "I'm sorry. I shouldn't have come." "Now don't start with that," he said mildly. "If you need help with something, and it seems like you do, then I'm glad you were able to find me. It must be pretty important for you to come all this way." "Thank you," she said quietly. They didn't discuss the matter further until after they'd found her wrecked striker unit and hauled it back to the shed next to the cabin. To Mio's slight surprise, it had weathered the crash fairly well, at least externally. It was still mostly in two pieces, and though dented, it didn't seem to have suffered any really significant structural damage. They found her eye patch at the crash site, not far from the spot where she had first struck the ground. It was intact, if soggy, having evidently been knocked clean off her head by the impact. She didn't seem interested in reclaiming it. Griffin, obscurely unwilling to just leave it there but not knowing what else to do with it, stuck it in a coat pocket and carried on. On the way back with the starboard engine unit, Mio seemed to notice something else on the ground. Pausing with a faint cry of surprise, she put down her end of the engine, picked it up, brushed it off, and placed it in the pocket of her jacket. Then, without comment, she resumed her burden and helped him carry it the rest of the way to the shed. Though she knew he had to be curious, Griffin didn't ask what she had found. He seemed to be in a complete no-pressure mode, determined not to ask her anything until she felt ready to start volunteering. One upside of these things being magical, Griffin mused as they lifted the engine up onto the workbench at the back of the shed. Even when they crash, they don't burn. He ran his fingertips across the face of the Sun and Moon Fuso Empire crest painted on the side of the unit, then studied the bladeless propeller hub, rotating it thoughtfully with his hand. And the etheric props mean no straightening out bent blades, which is good. I don't have the right tools for that out here. Said Mio, but nothing further. Griffin looked up from his consideration of the machine and put a hand on her shoulder. "Dinner must be just about ready," he said. Whatever was weighing on Major Sakamoto's mind, it clearly hadn't affected her appetite. She downed her half of the big crock of Belgad stew with gusto, putting Griffin in mind of a petite Japanese Paul Bunyan. That was one of the several things he'd always rather liked about Mio. Her straightforwardness, as regarded pretty much every matter he'd ever seen her tackle, from dining, or refueling, as he was sure she preferred to regard it, to military discipline. They talked about the old days. Older for him, as it turned out, than for her. His visit to what had turned out to be the summer of 1943 had happened many years ago from his point of view, while to her it was but the spring of 1945, not quite a year and a half later. Her coalition unit, the 501st Joint Fighter Wing, was still, or he gathered, back, together, still fighting the good fight against the increasingly incomprehensible enemy. By one miracle or another, they'd managed not to sustain any casualties. In fact, the roster had grown by two in the time since he'd visited. "You ever hear from Eleanor these days?" Griffin wondered, sipping his tea. "Every now and then," Mio replied. "She's with the 507th, posted up in darkest Swomus, so communications are spotty. But every now and then she and Sonya cross paths on the Night Witch radio network. And Ursula Hartman's in that unit, so Erica hears about her occasionally that way. She seems to be doing well." "Good, good," said Griffin. "As for the 501st, we've been back on the front line ever since they assigned us to take over from the 504th in Romagna, but we're staying strong," Mio told him as they lingered over tea. "The squadron's pulled together into a real family." With a slight smile, she added, "We've even had a few weddings. All completely unofficial, of course, but good for morale." Griffin raised an eyebrow, smiling. "Let me guess," he said. "Utilina and Litviak, Barkhorn, Hartman, and the rookies," she said, her smile turning sentimental in a way that would have surprised a more casual acquaintance. "Although it's hardly fair to call them that anymore, they've long since earned their spurs. The ones who joined after your time, Bishop and Miyafuji." She chuckled. "You'd like them both, particularly Miyafuji. She's the kind of girl who helps people whether they like it or not. Two-fisted compassion, more guts than sense, stubborn as a mule." "That does sound promising," Griffin agreed, grinning. "You'll have to pass my best on to all of them when you get back, even though the new kids won't have any idea what you're talking about." "Oh, they've heard all the stories," Mio assured him. "They're in the same unit as Shirley, Lucchini, and Hartman, so how could they not? I'm not sure they believe the ones about you, though. The flying man from the future, who wasn't a witch, but could fight like one. After what you and Sonya did to Allied G2 Britannia, the rest of the Allied forces think you're some kind of wartime myth. Like the Headless Horseman of Hanover. Well, that was more or less the idea, said Griffin philosophically. Mio looked into her teacup, swirling the dregs, and then said to it, I'm stalling. I know, Griffin replied, his tone unaggressive. She sighed, put down the cup, and raised her eyes to his, looking solemnly at him for a few moments. Then, without preamble, she said, I've lost my magic. Griffin blinked. Eh? It hasn't come as a surprise, she went on. Most witches' powers peak in adolescence, then fall off. Some more slowly than others, it partly depends on bloodline, and adulthood. A few of us remain powerful into old age, but for most, by the mid-30s or so, it's more or less over. For active aerial combat witches like me, it happens even faster. We exhaust ourselves on a much more regular basis than most, and every time we do, it takes a little longer to recover, until one day it doesn't come back. Most of us start restricting our combat hours by the time we're 18. Mina's done that, though being wing commander, she'd have had to cut back anyway, and retire altogether at around 20, so that we can preserve some measure of our abilities into adulthood. She trailed off, her right hand closing into a fist where it lay on the table next to her teacup. But you didn't do that, Griffin filled in, nodding. If I know you, you saw the first signs and pushed yourself harder. Mio chuckled bitterly. You do know me, she admitted. My shield failed last fall. My offensive power was down, too, and my endurance. She touched the grip of the katana she wore across her back. I made Repu Maru, mastered a whole new form of magic to compensate, but the joke's on me. It burned me up even faster. I guess some techniques are forbidden for a reason, eh? She added with a dark, mirthless little smile. When I realized that, she went on, studying the tabletop, I knew that soon I wouldn't have the strength to fly anymore. After that, the only thing left would be my special sight. It was the first magic trait I manifested, and it would be the last to go. She looked up at him again, meeting his eyes with her no longer mismatched ones. That happened last night, apparently. Griffin reached across the table and placed his left hand on her right, not gripping it, just resting atop it, a simple gesture of reassurance. He didn't otherwise interrupt, said nothing at all, as he waited for her to finish saying her piece. She gave him a grateful little glance, then looked away again, drawing and releasing a long sigh before she continued, And now I'm not a witch anymore. I'm just a normal woman, who never learned how to be one. If it happened to me, Fuji, she'd still be a doctor. Shirley would still be an ace mechanic, but me? Being a combat witch is all I know. With it gone, I'm no longer of any use to a world that still needs what I was. Mio shook her head and looked up at him again, her eyes suddenly alive with something much more like the fierce energy he remembered of old. I don't even know how to live like that, she said. I don't want to live like that. But when I finally accepted that there was nothing more I could do, I remembered something you said once, she said, withdrawing her hand from under his and rising to her feet. As she walked slowly around the table so that it would no longer be between them, she continued, About how what you do isn't magic as we know it, but it's like a kind of magic. And I thought, if there's any chance at all. She reached into her jacket pocket, then showed him the item she'd found in the woods, the WDF flight test challenge coin he'd given her back in 1943. He wondered why it had a length of black cloth ribbon tied around it, but kept quiet. "So I came to you," she said, closing her fist around the coin and holding it up almost defiantly before her. With what by then I had admitted was the last of my strength, I threw myself at the dark, trusting that if my cause was truly just, this coin would guide me to you. And it has. Griffin rose to his feet, so that their eyes were on a level again, and regarded her thoughtfully. He might not be a mage, but he knew enough of magic and of dimensional travel to know what a colossal working that had been, possibly better than she did. To traverse a universal veil, 4.5 centuries of time, and half the radius of the galaxy, and arrive within a few hundred yards of her target, and do it all at the very moment the last flame of her power was guttering and dying inside her. The thought moved him nearly to tears. "Mio," he said, but before he could say anything further, she drew herself up to something like attention, then bowed so deeply her forehead would have hit the table if she hadn't come around it first. "Please," she said. "Please. Onegaishimasu. I beg of you. I'll do anything you want, anything you ask of me, without question or hesitation. Just..." She hesitated, then went on without straightening up. "Just make me useful again." Griffin stood gazing at her for almost a full minute, a minute during which she held that deep bow without a quiver or an upward glance, and the only sound in the cabin was the ticking of the mantel clock. Taking a look at that clock, he noted the lateness of the hour. "Anything I ask?" he said speculatively. "Anything," Mio replied unequivocally. Ending the bow at last, she looked him in the eye and said unflinchingly, "I'm your student. I'm yours to command." "Hmm," said Griffin, rubbing pensively at his chin. Then he seemed to come to some internal decision. "All right," he said. Mio blinked, then bowed deeply again, tears in her eyes.
"Thank you,"
she whispered, unable to trust her voice not to break. "There's no need," Griffin replied. He crossed the distance between them and straightened her up with a gentle hand on her shoulder, then enfolded her in another hug. "Aren't we comrades in arms, you and I? Have we not heard the chimes at midnight? Or at least Jaeger snoring," he added, making her snicker in spite of herself. "I won't lie to you, Mio. I don't know for certain that I'll be able to help you. But, well, I know what it's like to lose everything that made your life make sense. If there's any way for me to help you take back the sky, I'll find it." They stood silently in the kitchen for a few moments, holding on. Then Griffin stepped back slightly, kissed her on the forehead, and said, "For right now, you should get some more sleep. You look terrible. You really have to learn to take better care of yourself, Mio," he deadpanned. "A girl's face is her fortune, you know." Mio blinked at him, the tears falling away from her eyes, and stared at his face in bemusement for a moment. And then she threw her head back, eyes closed, and laughed, big and round, "Ha, ha, ha," like she had in the old days. And in that instant, he knew that, one way or another, she would be all right. "All right, Sensei, but let's get started first thing in the morning," she said. "Sounds like a plan," he replied. She was halfway to the stairs when she paused, looked back over her shoulder, and said, "Are you coming?"
I beg your pardon? Griffin inquired. I can't very well expect my trainer to be effective if he sleeps on the couch, Mio said pragmatically.
That bed's plenty big enough for the both of us, unless you're shy all of a sudden, she added with a heartening echo of her old challenging grin.
Griffin gave her an exasperated look for a second, then laughed.
Sailors, he said with mock resignation, and then, come on, hound dog.
And they all went upstairs, turning out lights as they went. They arranged themselves back to back under the peak of the roof, with the lens hound curled up contentedly between them, wondering how lucky one dog could get. Once situated, Griffin reached to the only bedside table, which happened to be on his side, and shut off the lamp.
Sleep well, Major, he said. I'll most likely kill you in the morning.
There was a momentary silence. That last part isn't true, Griffin added. It's just what you say at moments like this. You'll understand later. Good night.
Mio chuckled. Good night.